Hello there, and welcome to my podcast. Here's a quick preview. Any message for the seniors, class of 2020? I feel like they'd love to hear from you.
Yeah, you know, class of 2020, God bless you. And I know this is not how you wanted this to end. It's going to be one hell of a party, though, next year. I know that. So, but no, seriously, class of 2020, it is a true blessing to have spent time knowing some of you and being able to kind of watch the group dynamic over the course of the past 4 years.
Hello there, and welcome to this podcast. I hope you're doing well. My name is Mopi. I'm from Bangalore, India, and a rising junior double majoring in business analytics and film, television, and theater at the University of Notre Dame, Go Irish, and a proud resident of Duncan Hall. I also post videos of my Notre Dame and travel experiences, so if you're interested in checking it out, you can find it on my website at vaibhavmopidevi.com, which is my full name, and if you're trying to spell that out, it's the name you see on the podcast app you're listening to this on. I am very excited for this week's episode of the podcast as we have the super cool Father Pete McCormick on air right now. He currently serves as the Director of Campus Ministry at the University of Notre Dame. In this role within the Division of Student Affairs, Father Pete oversees a staff of over 40 clerical, religious, and lay ministers tending to the spiritual needs of all Notre Dame students. A native of Grand Rapids, Michigan, he entered the Miro Seminary following his graduation from Grand Valley State University in 2000. 2 years later, professed his first vows in the Congregation of Holy Cross. While in the seminary, Father Pete worked at St. John Vianney Parish in Goodyear, Arizona, directing its confirmation program and teaching mathematics in the parish school, and also coaching the 5th and 6th grade basketball team. Returning to Notre Dame, he earned a Master's of Divinity in 2006 and was ordained a Holy Cross priest the following year. From 2007 to 2013, Father Pete served as rector of Notre Dame's Keough Hall. Following his time as rector, he pursued his executive MBA from Notre Dame's Mendoza College of Business, completing the degree in 2015. In addition to his current role in the campus ministry, Father Pete also serves as the chaplain to the Notre Dame men's basketball team. I am very excited to be speaking to him today. Hello, Father Pete. How's it going?
Moby, I'm doing good, man. So good to be hanging out with you today.
Yeah, thank you for being on the podcast. I was excited when I emailed you and you're like, let's do it. That was good energy. It made my day.
Hey, listen, I mean, this is a legendary podcast. I need to have some time with you, baby.
I am very excited to have this conversation. And my first question is about your background of where you're from. I saw in your bio that you're from Grand Rapids, Michigan. G-Rap, baby, as one of my junior friends from Grand Rapids first told me when I walked in as a first year. But I was curious to know your life back in Michigan, like growing up in Michigan, and how that was.
Yeah, I love the fact that you've got a buddy that's from G-Rap City, baby. It is it's such a good town. So I left it in 2000 when I entered Moreau Seminary and started planning to become a priest. And so life back in Grand Rapids, I'm the oldest of six, and went to a place called Grand Valley State University when I was doing my undergrad, which is just outside of Grand Rapids in this small town called Allendale. So I was there. And what I love most about Grand Rapids is it's home, man. That's like where my family, a lot of my friends are at. And so I love being able to go back and just kind of hang around. My mom is one of 11 kids. And so I grew up with a whole load of cousins all in the area. And so we would all spend a ton of time together, especially in the summers. We've got a family cottage that we would hang out at. So this summer, we'll see what happens with COVID. But I'm hoping to be able to get up and hang out a little bit. We'll see what happens.
That would be awesome. So I was curious to know, how were you like as a student in school? How was Father Pete as a high school student?
Father Pete as a high school student was diligent, hardworking, but took a lot of time to kind of get the right answer. It was one of these things where I was always acutely aware that I had other classmates who got there faster. And I'm like, what the heck? this is the reality of my life. I think it's taught me the discipline of just staying with a problem. So even though I didn't always finish first or anywhere close to it, for that matter, I'm really grateful for the fact that, you know, it taught me the art of perseverance of like, hey, listen, you're going to stick with it. It's not necessarily going to go as you had hoped, but at the same time, you're going to learn a whole heck of a lot in the process.
Sweet. So what did you major in college? What was your process of trying to figure out what you wanted to study?
So my process was one that I would not recommend to many people. My process was all over the place. I kept changing my major. I changed my major 5 times. And so whenever, you know, students come and talk to me today and they're like, well, I don't know. Or, you know, I just feel so torn. I'm like, yo, I understand. You have come to a very sympathetic audience. It took me 5 years to get through college because I kept changing my major so many dang times. But the two that I was really kind of bouncing back and forth between were pre-professional as to be a doctor, or the other piece was is to be a teacher. So those are the two that I really felt drawn to. I had an amazing high school biology teacher that I loved. He was so inspirational to me. Like, he taught me the human body in a way that I never really imagined. And this is my little priestly riff, but to me, the human body is the greatest example of the presence of God in our world. That the sophistication of our bodies, what they're able to do, to think, to feel, to create, to love, to hate, and all of the range of emotions. There's just something so beautiful about it. And so this biology teacher, Mr. Mulder, he was so good at making the whole world, the created world, come alive, that I thought to myself, that's what I want to do. That's what I want to study. So I knew I wanted to do biology. I just didn't know how I wanted to do it. And so how is it that I ended up as a priest with a biology degree? I don't know.
Yes,
I was just glad at that point, Moby, I was just glad to have a degree, man. I was just glad to have a degree.
Yeah, that was going to be my next question, actually. I'm glad you touched upon it. So you're in college trying to figure out if you want to do biology or something else. But then where does the question start arising in your mind that, okay, I'm considering being a priest? Like, what kind of mental questions do you have to ask yourself? How is it for you?
This is for me, what my experience was like. And I think depending on who you talk to, it's a variety of different angles and perspectives. What it came down to for me was I just had this call. All the way back to my sophomore year in high school, I started thinking about it. And frankly, I wasn't so thrilled with that idea. I was like, I got a few other ideas that I have that I think might be really exciting to entertain. But yet all the while, I do credit that to the fact that I could never really settle on a major in college. I just kept bouncing back and forth. And in part, it's because it wasn't A or it wasn't B, it was actually C. And not in rank order. It was just like the third option was actually the one I needed to pursue, which I gave no time to. So it started in my sophomore year in high school, and I started like thinking about it, and then I put it back on the shelf, and I'd say things like, oh, that is so far away. I don't need to think about this right now. But then, you know, you get to your second senior year, and you start thinking, shoot, man, I can't do a third. Mom and dad are going to be so hot on
too much.
Senior year.
This is too much.
Now I got to do something. And well, sometimes when your back's up against the wall, that's when some of your best stuff comes. So that's what happened to me.
Right. So I'm 20 years old now, and then most of Notre Dame's kids are between 18 and 22. And then Obviously I'm in so many conversations regularly. So I'm in Duncan Hall.
Yes.
And
go Highlanders.
Go Highlanders. So me and the Highlanders, multiple times I'll find myself having all these deep, deep conversations. As an 18 to 22 year old, you have so many questions on like the meaning of life, like what do I do with my career and things like that.
Yep.
So was that a challenging process for you? Did you have role models you looked up to find the way, or what were you thinking at that point?
Yes is the answer. I just want to do like a general statement first. No one, and I mean no one, gets to any place without a whole heck of a lot of help. Loved ones, friends, random passerbys, random YouTube videos, whatever the case might be, that there are constant points of inspiration that help and guide us. So for me, I mean, I start with my parents, right? My mom and dad were incredibly patient with me in this. You know, they continue to give me the chance to just journey and figure things out, as opposed to putting more pressure on me and saying, why is it that you finished 4 years in college and you're not yet clear on what you want to do? And when I came to them with the idea of going to the priesthood, they said, actually, we think that's a pretty good plan. We really like that idea, and we're willing to kind of roll with you depending on kind of how this thing unfolds. I mean, you enter the seminary, it's a 7-year process, Mopi. There's no guarantee you're coming out a priest on the back end. And in fact, it is probably just as likely that you end up leaving. So there was no guarantee. And they could have been like, dude, do you want to spend another 3, 4, 5, 6 years and then all of a sudden decide to leave on that? Like, buddy, just settle down and find something else to do. Buy a house. So all of those, so I would say certainly my mom and dad. And then I would also say, you know, and there's a number of people here, but I have an uncle too, who is on my mom's side, is my mom's brother. that was just very influential to me. I could pick up the phone at any point and he'd answer. And we just had a lot of conversations about life and how, you know, going different paths is okay. I remember feeling very much when I was your age, like there, I thought that there was just a path that everyone needed to follow. And it just felt like I just was the one similar to my high school career. Wasn't the one, I was just not figuring it out. Everyone was out ahead of me. And why am I going slow? And why is this taking me so much more time to figure out? What I realized later is that there's no one path. And it's a series of steps and it's a series of yeses. And so the more you can just willingly respond to kind of what you're being invited to do. And if you feel passionate about that, to accept that invitation, there's something cool about that. And it unfolds as a journey as opposed to like looking at, you know, Google Maps.
Right. I think we're all tuned to believe that there's only one right path many times. But like you said, it's not like Google Maps. I really like that reference.
So when you did make the decision, you stepped foot into the whole 7-year-long process or however long it can be, were you like, I made the right decision? Or would it father Pete do if you found yourself like questioning, did I do the right thing? Did I not do the right thing? Yeah.
You know, so the hard part about the seminary and perhaps the thing that folks don't always know is that it's a period of intentional discernment. It's 7 years of intentional discernment. You're constantly being asked to think and rethink about what you're doing with your life. And it was good. It was helpful. And it wasn't always the same question. But I do think that when you're discerning the nature of the priesthood is a beautiful thing. Of course, that's why I gave my life to it. I'm biased here. But yet it also asks of you very countercultural and challenging things at times. You're to be celibate. You're to be obedient to what the authorities of the church ask you to do. And then you're also to the degree that you possibly can, live poverty. And so to not necessarily be destitute, but at the same time, it will likely mean a variety of things that others may be able to do, I will not be able to do. And you have to be okay with that. So there's a series of years that takes to really discern and give your will over to that. But if you can look at the vows not as a list of things that you can't do, but actually as a list of freedoms that you are now provided with, then it becomes really interesting. So what does that mean? You're right, I can't be married, but that then sets me free to love others and to be available to others in a way that I otherwise couldn't be. From a monetary perspective, a poverty perspective, all of my supposed wealth, my quote-unquote wealth, comes from the Congregation of Holy Cross. So that also means that I don't have to worry about paying taxes. It also means that I don't have to worry about buying food. So there's a freedom in that. And then finally, the obedience part, right? Like, yeah, it's not always the greatest idea of being told what to do, but it's also pretty cool for someone to come up to you and say, hey, listen, I don't know if you've ever thought about X, but I think you'd be great for it. Like the reason that I'm at Notre Dame is because someone said, I don't know that you've ever thought about X, but I think you'd be really good. So I have to be very open to the fact that these vows that I've discerned have really fulfilled my life in a way that I couldn't have otherwise imagined.
I've always been amazed by the amount of sacrifice that people in the seminary make, but the way you just mentioned, talking about how you view it as a list of freedoms is something very interesting and something I've never thought of that way. So I think that's super cool.
What kind of people did you meet in the 7-year process? So this is why I asked the question. I think you'll find this a little interesting. I'm from Bangalore, India, so I'm an international student. I did not know Notre Dame existed for like the first 18 years of my life. Didn't know we had a football team or a Golden Dome. It was very random. I was just like online and going through posts. Every post about ND on that subreddit, it was just alumni raving about the university. And I was like, huh, if they love the university so much, I should probably look into it. Love the whole mission and things like that. So I applied. When I got in, I knew it was super cool. I knew it was special. But over my last 2 years here, did I actually know how crazy it was? When I pulled up, obviously, I had no perspective. And then I go to the ND versus Michigan game, 80,000 fans going absolutely berserk. And I'm like, this is crazy. And yeah, so what I think about in my 2 years here is like the people I've met, all these cool, interesting, crazy people. So in your 7-year process, I mean, also over your lifetime, but specifically in that process, what kind of people did you meet?
Yeah, there's so many. There's so many people. I'll give you two stories that kind of folks that I never would have encountered and still stay with me to this day. The first was I got assigned to St. John Vianney Parish for a year when I was in the seminary. And it was in a rural parish, although it was increasingly becoming more urban. Phoenix has parts of the city that, you know, the city grows by leaps and bounds every day. And so what was once rural, all of a sudden now it begins to have some pretty heavy infrastructure all around it. But there was, I was coming back from 6:30 in the morning mass, and there was one of our farmers from the parish. He was coming, and he did not intend to be caught or to be seen, but I just happened to be walking out at the exact time. And he was there, and he was leaving this basket of fruit that he had picked in the field as a gift to the parish. So I wanted to thank him. So I went up there and I was like, "Sir, thank you so much." And I shook his hand, Mopey. And I realized in that precise moment, it wasn't just fruit that he was giving me. He was giving me the fruits of his labor, the work that he had done, maybe even fruit that he would give to his family, he was giving to us as a gift. And that had a different meaning than just going to the local grocery store and buying a basket of fruit. And I also remember shaking his hands, and his hands were like boulders, man. This is a man who had worked with his hand. And at that point in time, I'm like trying to toughen up my hands because mine were not nearly as calloused. So that would be one story. The second story is similar. I had the chance to work in Phoenix, Arizona in a different setting down at Andre House, which is a place where we serve the poor and the homeless. So this parish was about 25 minutes away. And I had the chance to get to know some of the homeless down there. So one day I got sent to the grocery store to pick up some supplies. I can't even remember what I needed to pick up, but whatever. I went in, did what I had to do, came out, and I had this old beater of a car, and I opened the trunk, and whomever had left random things all throughout it. So I had my head way in the trunk, and I'm organizing the whole thing so that I could start to put these groceries that I just bought into the back end. While I'm doing this, this guy, random guy, walks past me. He's like, excuse me, sir, do you have any money? And I turn around, and it's one of the guys from the homeless center. And he goes, and he looks right at me, Mopin, and he goes, "Oh, Pete, I know you don't have any money. I'll see you tonight." Like, these are two encounters with people that I could have never anticipated. And so I just love it. I mean, I love, if I can kind of switch to the COVID piece right now, I think one of the hardest parts for me as a priest has been, you know, all of this isolation has really kind of impacted me or what I've struggled with, because I just so love people and I so love hearing their stories and spending time with them. It's impacted me harder than I thought. So I was grateful for this invitation, even though it is virtually, I am grateful for the invitation.
Oh, absolutely. This would have definitely been better in person on campus somewhere, but I'm glad this is still happening and we're able to talk.
So when I came in as a first year student, which was 2 years ago, I even remember the grotto, like the first grotto invitation. And that was my first introduction to you. And then my second encounter that I remember so vividly even now. So I was a Welcome Weekend ambassador last year.
Yep.
So when I entered into sophomore year, and you addressed like all the Welcome Weekend ambassadors and captains. And then when you walked in, when they introduced you, like people were going absolutely crazy. It was amazing. It was nothing like I've ever experienced in like a classroom setting. But I wanted to know,
growing up, were you always a confident speaker, and where does this energy come from?
Yeah. So I must admit, Mopi, that one of my real passions is public speaking. I remember very early on starting to do it and hearing people say, "Well, I get nervous," or whatever. I'm like, actually, I kind of enjoy it. And it's not like I enjoy it because everyone has to listen to me. I enjoy the opportunity to connect and to be able to share something that is important to me, which I think is a big difference. So that's where it kind of comes from. The whole challenge that I have to myself whenever I speak publicly is be authentic, be sincere, be genuine. Don't try to be someone else. Because people know that. People have an intuitive sense about whether or not they're getting the real deal or they're getting a bunch of BS. Mm-hmm. So my whole thing is that when I speak, I'm going to try to speak from the heart, and I'm going to let you know that I care. And then, you know, then I'll get out of your way. I'm not going to go forever either, you know? So that's kind of my approach, but it's very kind of you to say, man.
So what kind of preparation are we talking goes behind every time you address a huge gathering filled with thousands of people?
You know, the point that you have to start with is, what do you want to say? And I know that sounds trite, but what do you want to say? And is it authentic to yourself? Because the fact is that you have these people's attention, but interestingly enough, with public speaking, you can also lose their attention pretty quickly. Mm-hmm. So if you are not able to be authentic and genuine in what you have to say, then you don't got a snowball's chance mm-hmm. in hell. But at the same time, the other piece of it is really as a practice of trying and trying again. And there are times, man, where I'm like, I finish and I think to myself, I either kind of swirled on a point, I wasn't clear enough on a point, or I just didn't make the point. You know, so I do think that you have to have kind of an ability in the back of your mind to be to critically assess how you did. And the last thing I would say, and it builds upon the first point, you have to come in prepared. You mm-hmm. can't just wing it.
Right.
You know, like, you can't. You got to know what you want to say. But there are times in which it's like, and the point that I always heard said, and I think this is a really important one, which is, don't waste other people's time by not preparing something to say because mm-hmm. they're there. So I would say those three things would be really important. You know, have something that's true to you. Don't waste people's time, actually, like, and then also be able to kind of self-assess well enough to say, okay, this worked or didn't work. And you need to be able to modify as you come along.
So do you find yourself going over your speeches multiple times before you present to a very large audience?
You know what's really funny is yes, I'll go over them. So for instance, you know, I get asked to do the new student mass over Welcome Weekend. Mm-hmm. So that's kind of an intimidating proposition because it's, you know, 2,000 undergrads and then roughly 4,000 parents and guardians for a grand total of 6,000. Plus you then throw Father Jenkins in the background and all the other Holy Cross priests. And that's a nerve wracking scenario. So what I tend to do is I will go over it well enough, but where I will typically struggle when I'm practicing it by myself is that I don't have an audience to connect with. So I end up like really like stuttering and stammering and like being hypercritical of particular aspects of what I've said. And what I always find is that if I've done that part of the process, though, if I get out in front of people, all that nervous energy goes away. Cause I'm at the point now of, well, I've got something to say and all you guys are here and I'm the one with the mic. So let's go.
I love that energy. That's awesome. Right. So another thing, I mean, you probably noticed this over the last few years, but I've seen it my freshman year and my sophomore year, where in the football stadium at all the home games, we have that, I think it's like a 30-second segment or a 60-second.
Sure.
So and you know exactly what happens. Every time you come on that jumbotron, the energy in the stadium is unparalleled. And like for that whole segment, I mean, you must actually feel like a rock star, like at a concert. I can't imagine how it must feel. You must feel like a complete beast. Like, so how is that for you to take in? When did you find that was kicking off?
Yeah. So you know the backstory on this mass hype video is what I like to now call it was really about just trying to find a way to use the new video board. And so one day I get a phone call and they say, hey, we need a priest to serve as B-roll to the kind of video and the invitation to mass that we're going to offer. So that's what it was. We went over to the Basilica, did the recording, and I thought, okay, cool, we're done. So the first time it comes on, I'm like, you know, I'm with my buddies and we're like, yo, check this out. And then all of a sudden though, like parts of the student body start. And I'm like, I don't know, man, maybe they're just really excited about mass. But then when I started to see was this trend of like whenever my ugly mug would appear, all of a sudden it was like, and I thought to myself, oh. So it shifted then at that point. So all of a sudden I went from I went from like, ah, this is going to be kind of cool. There's a little video infomercial with my face on it, to the utter like humility and gratitude to the student body for such a beautiful gesture, you know? And it really, I mean, cause that video is not going to last forever. They're going to need to put other things up. So I will always, for the past 2 years, be able to be, to remember those moments and to be grateful to the students who were so kind to me. And I always like to make this point that if I had the capacity to cheer back in the most kind of broad scale way that y'all could hear it, I would do it, man, because it's mutual admiration. And I hope that you guys know that the reason I love being a priest, the reason I love being a priest at Notre Dame is because of the student body. And so it really is, it's mutual admiration in many ways.
I absolutely love that. I hope it's there for many more years to come so we can continue enjoying that tradition that's been built up.
So talking about students and the student body, you served as director of Keough Hall from 2007 to 2013. So how was being director? Is that something you wanted to be, or is that something that was presented to you, and how was that whole experience?
Yeah, no, I did not want to be rector. I thought that I would go back to Phoenix. That was really my plan. My last year of the seminary, the year before, I'd worked in Phoenix, and I thought, this is great. I love this parish. Let's do it. So I was just kind of like getting ready for that. And then I sit down, you know, you get assigned, remember obedience, you get told where to go. So I get sat down, and the person in charge makes a decision, says, we would like for you to be the assistant rector of Dillon Hall. Mm-hmm. And I'm like, Dillon Hall? And then, is there like a Dillon Hall Phoenix, or is there a Dillon Hall Arizona that's just outside of Phoenix? And there was not. Turns out it was right on South Quad. So at that point in time, my whole world just kind of changed. I went from planning to go work and do parish ministry to all of a sudden learning the residential life. And I didn't go to Notre Dame undergrad. I had no idea what that stuff was about. So I moved into Dillon, and I was there for about a year. And the plan was always that I was going to transition. I was going to transition into becoming a rector, but they knew, because I hadn't spent any time in the halls, that it probably would be good for me just to spend a little bit of time learning. So Father Paul Doyle, who's the rector of Dillon still, you know, gave me the year and taught me up. And then at the end of it, I got assigned to Keough, and I was able to serve as the rector of Keough for six. And I am so grateful for that time. And I look back on it so fondly. You know, this is that type of work, serving as the rector. You know, there are times it's hard, right? Because you got to keep weird hours. And you have to explain to your 30-year-old buddies, like, no, man, I'm going into work right now. So, like, so let's be clear. You start work at 8. You play video games for most of the night. You probably finish the night with pizza. And that's a job. Are we clear on this? I'm like, yeah, it's a job. So leave me alone. But obviously there's other more important work beyond that. But I mean, the ministry of presence, getting to know folks, being around, it was awesome, man. I'm truly grateful.
So how was it being responsible for like 200 dudes? And again, it's like 200 18 to 22-year-old dudes. You have to deal with so many random things.
Yeah.
So how did that help Father Pete like learn more about life?
Oh my gosh. Yeah, I mean, the thing you have to realize with 18 to 22-year-olds, especially all dudes living in a dorm, is that they begin to kind of settle into a certain routine and behavior pattern. So you have to try to figure out ways to like either live with that and give people enough space and latitude to be able to kind of bounce off the walls a little bit. And you also need to know where the line is.
Yeah.
So it's that constant navigating of, okay, I think he probably just needs to burn off a little steam, so we're going to let him. And, or this person, this person's been burning off a little bit too much steam, so let's figure out a way to cut that off. Mm-hmm. But what I love about guys is that they're, if you can show them and demonstrate your respect for them, if you can demonstrate that, they're willing typically to give you a lot of slack, even if you got to like shut down their party at 11:30.
Mm-hmm.
They're going to give you the benefit of the doubt because you've demonstrated the fact that you respect them. Like one of the more senior rectors said to me when I first got started, and I'll never forget this. He said, listen, there's going to come a time in which you have to bust a guy for this, that, or the other thing. But when that happens, you also need to make a point 24 hours later of reaching out to him and or bumping him bumping into him in the hallway and talking about anything but that particular thing. Because you need to be able to communicate that you see that person more than just the thing that went wrong. And I'll never forget that, man. That served me so well. I would always try to make a point of like, hey, listen, you have other interests in this world. You don't just always love to party at 11:30 at night with a beer bong. Mm-hmm. So let's talk a little bit about the things you are passionate about, the things that led you to this university, some of your goals, your hopes. And sometimes you can get through to people that way. So that's what I love. Every person's a little bit of a puzzle. And so you got to kind of be creative and thoughtful about how you crack that.
Yeah, I've had one of my closest friends is in Keo, actually. His name is Josh. And yeah, he was telling me that, did you know that Father Pete was like the rector here, dude? And I was like, what? No way he was the rector. So yeah.
It was awesome.
So yeah, the point I'm trying to get across to is like, you've been serving as multiple roles. Like now you're the director of campus ministry, which is obviously a huge role in itself, but you also served as director of Keo. How was it transitioning into like these very different tasks? Like,
yeah, man.
You only have to do different things. So how are you like bouncing around and able to still do them effectively?
Yeah. I always joke and say, I just can't keep a job. That's why they keep moving me around, man. So, you know, what I have found is that whenever you start a new job, the transition is just as important as the job itself. So when I became the rector of Keo, I had a year to transition in with Father Paul Doyle as it is his assistant rector. When I became director of campus ministry, I had the benefit of two things. One is the congregation sent me off to do an MBA, which helped me a lot in terms of business savvy, administrative approach, et cetera, et cetera. But then the second piece of the puzzle was I had the chance to work in campus ministry for a year as an associate director under the director at the time. And that gave me the chance to like not be the guy and learn what to do, what not to do, to figure out what really matters and what doesn't matter. All of those things are so absolutely important. Whenever you take on a new job, you know, you think about the opportunities that are there, and those are real, but you can't get the opportunities flowing unless you understand the organization as a whole. So it's a lot like, I mean, I love hoops, so it's easier for me to describe it this way. You know, everyone who sees a Michael Jordan kind of dunk, you see him dribbling down the court, elevate, and then throw it down hard. You're captivated by its beauty. But if you don't know how to dribble, you're going to get called for a travel long before you even have the chance to dunk it. Mm-hmm. And so the point I guess I'm trying to make is that if you want to be able to do something beautiful, if you want to be able to do something that you feel you're able to give your fullest self for, the preparation is just as important as the job itself.
So as director of campus ministry, obviously Notre Dame is known globally for its like emphasis on faith. I don't remember which lecture exactly, but the professor was saying that over time, like it started off with many universities having like faith as one of their strongest aspects over like 200 years ago. But yep. Over time, like every university decided to like not have it be like their core guiding principle or like their core principle. But Andy, even today, I'm actually truly amazed by it, is so proud to be like a Catholic university. So, and faith is one of the most important aspects, and you're director of campus ministry where faith is such a big aspect. So I feel like, I don't know, do you feel a lot of pressure on you to take certain decisions?
Yeah, thanks so much for that question, Mopi. I do, man. I mean, it's interesting, but the way I think about the pressure is not, I don't want to screw this up. The way I think about the pressure is that I've been asked, I've been trusted to steward this philosophy, this ministerial approach, this way by which we educate our students that's been handed down since 1842. And so how fortunate am I to be able to carry it for the time that I have it? And so I always like to make the point, like, listen, there's going to be another director of campus ministry, and that next director of campus ministry is going to be really talented and be able to provide some things that I myself could not. Mm-hmm. So really my responsibility is to be a good steward with the time that I've been given and to realize that I carry this torch for a period of time and then I'll hand it off. And so for me, and I bring that up to say, like, I do think of a philosophical approach that's very helpful with jobs and positions like this is the more you make it about you, the less successful you will be. Mm-hmm. The more you make it about others, and elevating them, the more successful you will be. That's what I have found to be key. When I was the director of Keio, I tried to empower my RAs as best as I possibly could. When I'm in my work now, I try to empower my people with the information and the ability to make the decisions as best as I possibly can. And I think that's really key. And because the fact is like, there's no one way that just the director of campus ministry can solely kind of carry the torch for all faith on campus. It's impossible. So why even try? Point is, but if you bring in 40 people and then you think about rectors and you think about other people of great will and then the student body, then you've got something. But mm-hmm. you can't make it about yourself. You've got to make it about being a steward of the position, inviting other people into the process, and then seeing where you go from there.
Do you feel like with your popularity on campus that there's an additional pressure while you're making decisions?
I'll quote Coach Bray on this. I asked him one time, because, you know, like after a game, win or loss, he's got to go and he's got to, you know, sit down and he has to kind of talk to the media. And I asked him, I was like, Coach, when it's hard, how do you navigate that relationship with the media? And he says, I just tell them the truth. And I thought that was so helpful. Like, it was so straightforward. And so what I try to do with whomever I'm around is be authentically myself. I want to treat them as I would hope to be treated. I mean, you'll find, Mopi, in time that there are things in your life that other people are going to look at as great successes, but you're going to realize that doesn't define you. Mm-hmm. And so my recommendation is don't let these things define you. Be grateful that they're in your life, but grateful from a distance to the mm-hmm. point that they don't solely become you.
Right.
And that's what I try to do, man. I'm like, I'm Pete McCormick from Grand Rapids, Michigan. I'm the oldest of six, who took 5 years to get through college, who's currently the director of campus ministry, trying to do the best he can with it. And I'm imperfect as all hell. And this is what I'm going to try to do. And I'm never going to have any kind of airs with people. Like, this is who I am. And if you want to spend some time sitting down talking, great. I'm down. And I'll shoot it to you straight. That's really how I think these things through.
I love the humility that guides all your actions. I think your kickback nature in general just makes it easier for students to be able to connect with you. And I'm sure a lot of people appreciate that.
So in general, you know how everyone has their own like MD story. Everyone's come from their own different aspect. And how do you feel like your MD story has developed over time? And how does the future look like?
Yeah, you might. Okay, so it's really important to note here. I did not know where Notre Dame was when I applied for the seminary. So we're talking like in 1999 and in 2000, I did not know where Notre Dame was, okay? I figured it out at that point because I had applied to the seminary and I was like, oh, it's only 2 hours away from my hometown, due south. So my Notre Dame story over the course of the past 20 years has been a bit of a rocket ship, man. If you had said to me, if you'd gone back to my junior year in college self, and said, hey, man, listen, in 2 years, you're going to leave Grand Rapids and you're going to live in South Bend, Indiana for the better part of your life, at least for the next 20 years, I'd have been like, yo, what? And then you're going to have these amazing people that you're going to come in contact with and experiences that you can only imagine right now. So my Notre Dame story has been nothing but blessing. It really has. And not to say that it's always been easy. There are days that are truly hard and difficult. But if you have the ability to look back on 20 years and say, yeah, there was some difficulty, but at the same time, there was a whole heck of a lot of blessing. I would say that's true. And I'm forever grateful to be here and for as long as I'm needed or before someone says, hey, listen, we need you to go here, I'm going to try to do the best that I can with it.
Right. So I told you about my first football experience. How was your first ND football game? How far does that go back to?
Oh my gosh. So, I mean, I don't know that I can tell you all the way back, but I can remember certain things that I used to love when I was in the seminary. I mean, I loved all of a sudden Friday afternoon, all of a sudden these families would just appear out of nowhere. You're like, hey, where'd you come from? You know, and you're like potentially getting hit in the head by a little kid throwing a football to his dad. And then the colors start turning. And then, you know, I loved inviting my family down for games and they watching them come to understand Notre Dame differently and being able to stay for a weekend. My mom, my dad, and my aunt and uncle have come down for 20 years straight.
Wow.
To a football game. And wow. they just, like, this is their thing. And I think they love that time so much. And they all have their own rhythm. They come down, they stay at Moreau Seminary, and mm-hmm. They have a select time when they go get coffee in the morning and eat a donut and then go for a walk. And look, there's like certain ritualized things. So, man, I mean, it's just woven into my very life's existence. But I do remember one of the most crushing games of Notre Dame football.
Tell us.
Was when the Bush push occurred. I don't know if you remember this history, but ultimately Charlie Weiss is very early on in his time as the head football coach. We are all of a sudden like playing much better. Late in the season, here comes USC. USC has Matt Leinart at quarterback and Reggie Bush at running back. Two guys who would both go play in the NFL, and I think two guys who both won Heisman trophies. So all of a sudden, Moby, at the end of the game, we are in it. We actually think for a period of time that we won the dang game. Well, we didn't. And then all of a sudden, Matt Leinart throws a ball that just passes the outstretched arms of our cornerback. Wide receiver catches it, runs down the field. And then with the last remaining seconds, Matt Leinart does a quarterback sneak to get in the end zone. And Reggie Bush, behind him, pushes him into the end zone. Now, at the time, that was very illegal. And so it's not called as the Bush push. But you went from watching the stadium be absolutely euphoric, like we just beat USC, and we just lost to USC. Ooh, it was brutal.
And you experienced that live? You experienced that live?
Oh, I watched it live. I literally watched as our players, in celebration of the win that they thought that they had, threw their helmets into the air. And they started landing on the field. They thought it was over. It was like, it's in. We did it. That was crushing.
Ouch. Yeah, that sounds so painful. I know I've gone to talk to some of my ND friends' parents who also went here when they talk about when we won the championship. And the way they describe it, I feel like so many alumni have so many incredible stories of their time here. And one of the things that amazed me about Notre Dame, coming from like a perspective where I've never heard of ND, like how genuinely strong like the ND network or the ND family is, right, and how seriously it's taken. How does it become that strong is what I'm so curious about. Like, I mean, as you're like in the leadership of the university, how do you guys feel about how strong and expansive the network has been? Is it something you're actively trying to bring the alumni together, or is it just the way ND has always been?
Well, I think it starts with the dorms. I really do, man. I think that the dorms, you know, I get the fact that some are not as fancy as others, but yet all of them bring people together and people from different backgrounds and perspectives. And all of a sudden you have this group of friends that you never could have otherwise imagined. It starts there. And then, I mean, how often do you hear over the course of a semester, the importance of community, right? Community, community, community.
That we all the time. Yeah.
We beat that drum, baby. So it's not lost. It should not be lost on anyone that when folks graduate, they're like, well, we got to keep building this thing. And then this is where, you know, the great work of the Alumni Association, they do just an amazing job of making sure that folks stay connected. And you've got alumni clubs and you've got opportunities to come back in the summer for reunion and all these different types of opportunities that just continue the Notre Dame family. And so I think that domers like being around domers. And so it is also not a surprise to me from a career and networking opportunity that they're typically willing to help. At minimum, they'll be willing to have a conversation and say, hey, listen, these are some pieces of advice. Have you found that at all?
Oh, 100%. Absolutely. Multiple upperclassmen have gone out of their way to help me connect with people that they interned with or alumni they know who would be willing to speak to me. And even on LinkedIn, I found once or twice when I was curious about an industry that I was able to reach out to those alumni, say, hey, you guys have 15 minutes to talk. And till now, I haven't been denied a call yet. So definitely something powerful here. And I'm very, very happy that I chose to come to ND. And there's an alumni network that's so loving and willing to give back.
That's so good, man. And kudos to you for getting on that, right? I mean, because it's an incredible gift and asset to being a part of the university, of having this big collection of people who are out there who just totally care and want to help. But sometimes, you know, like folks don't pick up the phone because they're nervous or whatever the case might be. So it says a lot about your willingness to say, hey, I'm gonna give this a shot.
Thank you. I can still remember when I started pursuing this idea of being able to try and interact with a lot of people in college. It was when my RA freshman year, Mark Hershey, super cool guy, and we were having a conversation, and he said two things that I remember very well. The first was that at no point in your whole life will you be surrounded by 8,000 incredible, loving students, and they're all only 5 minutes away from you. So it's always, you have easy access to this whole incredible community. And the second thing he said was, even as a senior, that he was still meeting so many new people. And it really hit me that no matter how many people you meet in your time here, you still have more people to meet. So yeah, that was what hit me like a truck.
Right? What was it about that moment that hit you?
It was like how limited time was in college. This quarantine thing really made me feel each day, because I'm in the Morrison right now.
Yeah.
I can literally wake up and feel how long each day is. But in college, I wake up and then boom, it's the next day. You're always around people you like. You're always talking. The energy is out of the roof. Like, things are always happening. And you're like, where is all this time going? So after my freshman year, I'm like, I need to make the most of this. I can't let this go. What would your advice be for like kids, I mean, college kids in general, but kids who go to Notre Dame, on how they can make the best use of their time here, which is so limited?
Yeah, I really, really, really would say seize the moment. Don't take it for granted. Sometimes I think that the worst thing that can happen to Notre Dame students is that they come to Notre Dame their freshman year. And let me explain that. Because you just assume that that's normative. Like, every college experience is just like this. And it's not to downplay my college experiences, but I went to a community college for 2 years, and then I went to GVSU, and I received a great education. But the first time in my first year at Notre Dame, a professor at Thanksgiving said, hey, anyone who doesn't have a place to go for Thanksgiving, you can come to my house. I almost fell out of my chair. I'm like, what? Really? He just invited, it was a class of 55 people. He just invited them all to Thanksgiving dinner. I had no words for that. I was like, I don't know. So I would say Notre Dame is a special place. Notre Dame is a place that looks out for this community, and take advantage of that. But I would say, don't just take advantage of it, give back to it. Bring what is uniquely you and your unique passions to it. Share yourself with it. I think sometimes people hold back too. They're afraid to step out of the norm, you know, for whatever reason. And I think that all of a sudden there's this kind of like pressure to kind of align yourself with other people around you. And I would say, one, benefit from the wisdom that's in this community, but two, contribute to it. Bring yourself authentically to that. So those would be my two pieces of advice.
Thank you. That is great advice. So moving into the end of the podcast, I'm curious to know how, I know we touched upon it a little bit, but how has the coronavirus pandemic affected Father Pete? How has your thought process changed? What have you been thinking a lot?
Yeah. I mean, there's a lot of things I've been thinking about, but so that this podcast does not go 3 hours, I'll bring it down to a couple things. The first is how... I will never, as long as I live, take for granted the opportunity to sit in the presence of another person and not feel anxious about something that they might possess themselves that could somehow do me harm. And I think that that's going to take us a long time to recover from. Mm-hmm. This kind of fear of the other that I get the dramatic reality that we face. It's a pandemic. But I just hope and pray that we don't lose track of our humanity, that let our desire to be human towards one another dictate our terms. And I think it's possible to be both human and aware medically of what we can and can't do during this time. That's one of the kind of principles that I've been thinking about a lot. The second is, I miss being a priest. I miss celebrating Mass. I miss hearing confessions. I did a baptism yesterday, and I was so excited. You know, I was so excited. I've got Mass this Wednesday, and I'll do Mass. Mm-hmm. With me, a cantor, and a reader, and the basilica will be empty. I miss being able to preach at a full church. Those are the types of things that I would love. I'm sitting here in Stanford Hall, and the entire mm-hmm. building is empty short of the rector. Me and the rector have been holding it down. The other day, there was a fire alarm that got pulled, and you've probably been a part of a Duncan fire alarm a time or two, where you walk outside and everyone's bleary-eyed and, you know, in varying states of dress. And I walked out at 12:30, and it was me and the rector. That was it. It's just so bizarre. So you know, those are some of my thoughts.
Yeah, I definitely feel like this is a very challenging time for colleges across America and the world around, but especially for ND, because the dorms are so tight and well-knit, and people live in close proximity to each other. And yeah, the university must be having to make some tough decisions right now.
Oh yeah, for sure. I mean, you have to think about the safety of students. We know what we want to be doing. We know what we prefer to be doing, mm-hmm. but the world turned. The world's changed. So now we have to kind of recalibrate and figure it out. This to me is, it's one of those moments that it will define probably our next 20 years in terms mm-hmm. of what we do and what new traditions we establish. And you know, I certainly have a little experience of this having gone through 9/11. I watched as the world turned then, mm-hmm. you know, like the security measures and the protocols that all got put in place, that we're going to come back to a campus at some point that is much more medically aware of kind of what, how one can look out for another based upon their own personal hygiene and how mm-hmm. they're caring for themselves and who they're spending time with, those realities that we're all going to face. So I think it's going to be an interesting evolution of our community, but let's be really clear. The Notre Dame community can withstand a whole heck of a lot. We've withstood challenges in the past to the point that you made just a little bit ago. This thing is electric and has the capacity to overcome even this. So I'm hopeful. It's just going to look a little different.
Mm-hmm. What's one thing that Father Pete's looking forward to doing when the restrictions are eased? Is there anything you really want to do that you cannot be doing being quarantined right now?
Yeah, I want to go home. I want to go mm-hmm. just drive up to my home in Grand Rapids. So I've been kind of steering clear of that for the time being. Mm-hmm. But I would love to be able to go spend some time up in Grand Rapids with my family. I mentioned earlier, we've got a cottage up in northern Michigan. And that piece of property is like a little piece of heaven for me on earth. It's where all my childhood memories, it's where a lot of the world just makes sense to me. So I'm going to get up there at some point. It's just a matter of when.
I pray you get to go very soon and meet all your family. I'm sure that'll be an awesome experience seeing them after so long. And do you have any message for any members of the Notre Dame family who might be listening to this podcast, either alumni or students or faculty?
Stay hopeful. Stay hopeful, man. As we're in the midst of this, it's you know, the Christian faith is ultimately rooted in hope, that we believe that God can transform all types of things, you know, and not to get too preachy at the end, but, you know, we have crucifixes in all of our rooms. And the point of the crucifix is not to speak solely to the fact that Jesus suffered before he died, but that very cross was ultimately transformed in the resurrection. That the people who had the courage to gaze upon the cross with the curiosity about how God could transform it ultimately were just in awe and wonder when Jesus came walking in the door. So I really do think that hope has to be our posture that we find ourselves in right now. Even when there are times in which it sure feels like, you know, the days are long and sometimes a bit too dark for our preferences.
Mm-hmm. Any message for the seniors, class of 2020? I feel like they'd love to hear from you.
Yeah, you know, class of 2020, God bless you. And I know this is not how you wanted this to end. It's going to be one hell of a party, though, next year. I know that. So, but no, seriously, class of 2020, it is a true blessing to have spent time knowing some of you and being able to kind of watch the group dynamic over the course of the past 4 years.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I'm sure they'd appreciate that. Any final thoughts that you have? Any closing thoughts?
No, Moby, I think you should start thinking about kind of how you're going to have a whole broadcast empire, baby. You're really good at this. Really appreciate the invitation.
Thank you so much. That really means a lot to me. And yeah, I just want to say that I personally am saying this, and I'm sure a lot of the student body would agree, that you bring a special magic to all the situations you're in, whether you're addressing people or hosting mass or among the many things you're involved in on campus. You're always able to bring this radiance, and we really appreciate it. So thank you again.
Thanks, brother. Thank you. Really appreciate it. And the feeling is mutual, man. It is so neat to just see the curiosity that you have. And you know, you talked to me about being pumped up. The joy that you bring to this interview makes this conversation so fun and exciting.
Thank you. Thank you for listening. If you enjoyed the podcast, make sure to subscribe for more. And if you want to catch me on social media, my Instagram is @VibeOfMopiDevi. And if you're curious to see how to spell it out, it's the name you see on the podcast app right now. And catch you soon, and stay safe.
Peace.